Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 19th of November, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio again today is Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, we're going to get straight on with our favourite leader, Theresa. Here she is speaking at the Confederation of British Industry this morning. I was going to let people hear a little bit of what she said, but I figured actually, we'd all heard enough of her on Friday's programme. I couldn't bear to put our viewers and listeners through Theresa May again today.
No need to traumatise them at the beginning of the programme.
Absolutely. So what was she talking about? Of course, Brexit. What a great deal it is. She said it allows us to leave the institutions we don't want to be part of. For example, the Common Agricultural Policy, the Common Fisheries Policy. She said it sorts out immigration, no problems there. Europeans will not be able to jump the queue over people from, for example, Sydney or Delhi in the future. It will be skills-based immigration and we'll have control of our open borders. And that really was the message. The borders will still be open. Everybody's welcome to come in, but we'll have control of it. And it means that European citizens will not get priority over other citizens of the world. So we're truly becoming having a global immigration policy in the future.
What about Syrian militants?
They don't seem to be a problem. We can bring those in at any time. They're not even going to be bothered with this
ISIS,
silly red tape.
ISIS fighters, jihadists.
Absolutely.
It's all good. Okay.
Absolutely. She said, you know, they're now going to concentrate much more over the next couple of weeks in their discussions with the European Union on the future relationship. She said that while manufacturing and goods are sort of important, really services is the most important thing. And of course, what she's talking about is financial services. And she said that the regulation of services going, you know, in the future would be pretty much coordinated with the European Union. So really, we're not leaving at all, as we've said time and time again. And she was making the point that in the future, government would be very much in partnership with business. Now, the rest, that was the first sort of 15 minutes of the speech that she gave, Patrick, and then the rest of it sounded like a party political broadcast, almost as if she was preparing for an election. But anyway, that's just my observation. Well, in the meantime, we're being told we've got to seize the moment and deal with the House of Lords. And we've mentioned this a couple of times over the last couple of years, Patrick, that the Brexit campaigners are really pushing forward to urge reform of the House of Lords. And the point that I've been making on this time and again is that who in, you know, the last 20 or 30 years, who is the individual who really brought forward reform of the House of Lords more than any other?
Well, it has to be TB.
TB,
Tony
absolutely.
Blair.
So it's perhaps a little ironic that the Brexit campaigners seem to be the people that are pursuing TB's political policy to destroy the House of Lords. Now, of course, the issue with the House of Lords is that it's being presented as an undemocratic institution because the Lords are not elected, they're appointed. And I'm by no means suggesting that the House of Lords is a perfect institution. It's far from it. But what's being proposed as an alternative is, in fact, a fully elected House of Lords, where the Lords would be whipped, just as the Commons is. Now, this is, we do not have a US-style political system in this country, Patrick, and so if the situation in the United States in the, between the House and the Senate is bad enough, that would be amplified in this country. And remember, the Lords' role is to put limits and reins on an out-of-control government, an out-of-control House of Commons. I think everybody should be able to agree that in recent months and years, the House of Commons is increasingly out of control, and any suggestion that we should remove protections from that behaviour, I think is pretty dangerous.
I think traditionally, if you look at the House of Lords, when they've been most effective is when they're an independent chamber, Mike. So to make the House of Lords effectively, like you said, a partisan chamber and have a whipped upper chamber, I can think of no more dystopic vision of the British constitutional system in the future, if that was the case. The other thing, Mike, is that that opens the door when you bring in partisan politics into a chamber like that to have effectively a Senate in Britain. It invites a lot of big money, Mike, big corporate money, and you have a situation like you have in Brussels now where the lobbyists outnumber the MEPs by an incredible ratio. I don't know the exact number, Mike, but there's, I don't know, 10 lobbyists to every politician in Brussels right now. I think you could expect the same thing if you politicize the House of Lords in the way that Tony Blair envisioned it, I believe, from the late 90s.
Okay, well, look, let's stick with Brexit to a degree. But a number of newspapers had this this morning, Patrick. Operation No Deal, Army plans for troops on the streets. So preparations for there being a no deal situation. But what is being normalized here seems to be the military and the police working together.
Yeah, the last time we saw this, Mike, a few crises, but you can see they're talking about 20 officers from Operation Tempur, which you can comment on in a minute, ordered to step up operations in the event of a no-deal Brexit situation, fears of chaos in the streets resulting from Theresa May facing a no-confidence vote, Mike. And then it goes on, the other things we need to worry about, they are focused on how the military could help the police to keep public order and how medicines could be delivered to hospitals, if you can believe it. So they're really pumping the fear chart here for some sort of, you know, civil unrest, as it were, shortage of supplies, you know, all sorts of problems. And you have to like this one. Also drawing up plans for using military troops to help ease traffic chaos in Kent. I guess they're envisioning the closing of the Channel Tunnel and all these things that aren't going to happen. Either way, Mike, you've already explained it's not going to happen. But yet, here is the Deep State Times. If the Deep State, and we say this again, if the Deep State had a paper, it would be the Times. If you want to know what the Deep State would like the public to believe and think, just read the Times. Read the Times every day, and you'll know exactly what the Deep State wants in your life. And let's look at the numbers, though, Mike. What does the British public actually think about this Brexit deal? And you can see, in terms of the numbers here, general summary, 19% support what Theresa May is offering on this draft, 42% oppose, and this is the important number, Mike, it's in the middle, 39% don't know, basically, and that's where the real battleground is. And if you want to sum this up between Leave and Remain, 42% of Leave voters oppose, 47% of Remain voters oppose. So the battle lines are drawn here, and the press loves this, Mike, because they now can nicely compartmentalize the public and create a sort of football terraces situation, which is exactly what the Times, I'm sure, would love, and many of the media would love for some civil unrest to break out. But in my view, Mike, a lot of this is contrived.
Absolutely.
But Operation Tempur, you've covered this in the past, haven't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the code name, the government name for the operation, which puts the military in policing roles. And this is something that we've been watching for a number of years. In 2015, in October, November time, there was a European Defence Agency conference. Federica Mogherini and Jens Stoltenberg from NATO were both at that. And they were discussing this issue of merging civilian and military, militarised policing roles. And we then had subsequent follow-up press releases from NATO about how NATO was having so-called non-lethal weapons deployed, basically battery rounds, plastic bullets, whatever you want to call them. So this is a policy which has been being discussed for quite a number of years now, and we're starting to see it on the streets. Now, we've discussed in recent days how this is something perhaps the Europeans are much more used to, with the sort of gendarmerie type and in Italy as well, they've got the same type of policing going on, and in Germany. But this is something which is very much different for the UK. And the question is, how would British troops react under these circumstances? If they are British troops, then I think they would probably be reasonably well behaved with regard to the public. But if it's a unified European military force that ends up as part of this operation in a few years' time, would the situation be the same?
I think the main point, Mike, isn't it ironic that Britain, who wants to retain its independence, who wants to retain its uniqueness, and one of the things that makes Britain unique is that it doesn't have this merger of military and police forces, Mike, and yet the Brexit fear-mongering is basically spinning up this very scenario to make Britain just like Europe with the merger of military and police. So I find that very ironic how the narrative is coming full circle there. Amazing.
Today the European Foreign Affairs Council is taking place and they're going to discuss Central Asia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Ukraine, Yemen, but they're also going to have a joint session with defence ministers to discuss major initiatives in EU cooperation in the field of security and defence. Here's what Federica Mogherini had to say about that this morning.
Today and tomorrow we gather the foreign and the defence ministers of the European Union for a very intense agenda. And together with the defence ministers, we'll continue our work to strengthen the European defence. In particular, today I expect ministers to see how our permanent structured cooperation is going, with 17 new projects to be adopted. And tomorrow we will have Jens Stoltenberg, NATO Secretary General, to continue our work to strengthen EU-NATO cooperation.
So that was the beautiful Federica there. And of course, as you heard, she was talking about European cooperation and security and defence. They're going to be discussing permanent structured cooperation, CARD as well, and the various other European defence institutions, European Defence Fund, military mobility, military planning and conduct capability, civilian CSDP compact, and the proposal for a European peace facility. It goes on, more and more military style institutions being established. A very large part of this today is going to be all about EU-NATO cooperation. Patrick, this is probably the one issue that many people are not getting to grips with at the moment, this issue of EU and NATO cooperation, because in the UK, when this issue is discussed, politicians and so on always say, well, no, we will be cooperating with Europe as a member of NATO. But this is not the case, because EU countries are already members of NATO. What is happening here is the unification of EU countries' militaries, including Britain's, and the EU will have the relationship with NATO rather than individual nations. And the danger here for me, Patrick, is that if we think back to 2013, for example, when public opinion managed to get the bombing of Syria stopped, because Britain was leading that, potentially leading that bombing campaign, what this effectively does is take that decision out of the hands of Parliament, puts it into Brussels, where it's going to be much harder for the British people to decide not to bomb a foreign country or not to intervene in a foreign country. It'll be done at the European level with single point command and control, as David Ellis talks about. Removes any influence that we have on this, on these types of operations.
I think when we did the reported on the on EU military unification earlier, Mike, one of the earlier points I make was a political point, which dovetails with what you just said. The most important aspect that if you're watching and you're trying to figure out what does this actually mean, let me just to break it down very simply. If you don't have an independent defense or an independent military, whether you're going to use it or not is beside the point. But the fact that it's not independent, you cannot have an independent foreign policy unless you have your own independent military. So in other words, your foreign policy becomes Brussels' foreign policy. So you don't have any say, because the EU defense force, the unified defense force, has to act, and it's going to act in concert with all of the EU countries. So that decision is going to come out of the hands. You're not going to be able to opt in or opt out, Mike, especially if there's interoperability. In other words,
which is exactly the way it's established.
Each country is going to have a certain capability that's going to need to bring to the table together with other countries in the event that they're going to deploy. So you won't be able to just opt out of decisions you don't like. Or we don't want to get involved in that war in Iran because we just don't think it's a good idea. Well, it's going to be really difficult. If that does happen, Mike, it could create a crisis for Europe, actually. It could, because Europe, it could come to a screeching halt if that happened. And that could be an EU crisis at that point. So we don't know how it's going to play out. It could play out very badly for Europe, or the United States would just say, oh, you haven't got your act together, we're going in to do it. So again, the U.S. will be able to reassert its power, even with a full-blown EU defense force sitting on the tarmac, deciding or squabbling amongst each other as what to, of whether to act or not. It's probably better that they don't act in most cases.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, NATO is the U.S.'s hand into European affairs and geopolitics. So if you take away NATO, you take away the U.S. hand, but the U.S. hand will still come and intervene in another way, and it could be as a result of EU inaction.
This morning on RT, they hosted this program. If you look on the RT website, for U.S. will be hostage to partisan bickering for next 2 years, according to CIA veteran. This is Rolf Moat Larsen. And they say, as the rift between the U.S. and the rest of the world grows wider, at home Democrats are now in control of Congress. How big of a game changer is the result of the U.S. midterms for the rest of the globe? We talked to Mr. Larsen, but with a large part of this conversation was a discussion about Macron's comments about EU military unification, and then Trump's subsequent comments sort of making fun of the idea of EU military unification. Now, the point here is that Trump has been calling for the EU to pay their way on defense for the last 2 years. I think we reported it.
Within NATO.
Within NATO, that's right, that's right. But the point, Pat, is, isn't it, that in order to bring forward the policy of unification, national spending on military has been cut, and there have been cuts, and this is to do with the interoperability issue again, because we've had to cut certain areas of our military, the French have had to cut certain areas of their military, so that we can fit those two together, right? Now, under those circumstances, once that deal is done and the unification has happened, the EU has already made it clear that they're going to start ramping up spending. Now, if it becomes the United States, the EU, as the two main partners in NATO, in fact, this works. This plays into Trump's demands, does it not?
Yeah, it does, because the U.S. needs to preserve NATO as its entree into European affairs and geopolitics vis-a-vis Russia or anything else on the sort of Eurasian periphery, the Balkans, for instance, as well. So, yeah, it does play. So you're talking about a reformed NATO. That will be a big step, Mike. That's going to be a potentially painful move or not. It could be done by fiat. It's difficult to say how it's going to play out.
I just remind everybody once again, it's a number of years now that Mogherini and Stoltenberg have been working together dealing with the EU-NATO relationship. They've produced joint declarations about how it's going to work. They're meeting again today to discuss how it's going to work. This isn't something which is suddenly going to be dropped on everybody's heads. It's something that they've been working at for years, in fact.
Yeah, the problem with an independent European unified force, Mike, is if it's too independent, this is going to be a problem for the United States. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you right now, it's just going to be problematic in many different ways. If it's dependent, or if it's a poodle to Washington, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to work out great. It'll be just like a window dressing change for Washington. But if leadership emerges, Mike, nationalist leadership or some strong characters within the current EU framework emerge that don't want to be subservient to Washington, then there's going to be friction in terms of decision making, in terms of geopolitics. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, speaking of Trump and the CIA, Patrick, what's going on?
Well, here's the New York Times. This is on the other side of the Atlantic, the Deep State Times, the New York edition. So Trump versus the CIA, Mike, this isn't the first time we've seen this theme. And I think you'll probably point out another example of this. But this is kind of how Russiagate and how that whole controversy has been structured. John Brennan and all these, James Clapper, the Never Trump crowd. So two different headlines appear essentially in the same day. The first one, Trump says, we're convinced, we were told he did not play a role. He's talking about Mohammed bin Salman in the Khashoggi killing, says Trump of the Saudi crown prince. That's what Trump says. And then here comes the other headline. The CIA concludes Saudi crown prince ordered the killing of Khashoggi, says the CIA with a high degree of confidence. I stress those words. Those are the words they used. High confidence, their assessment that MBS ordered the killing of Khashoggi, and obviously the evidence they have for that is some intercepted phone calls days before the alleged killing. I say alleged because no one's produced a body yet, but that's another story. So Trump versus the CIA, this is the theme, Mike. Mm-hmm. So is this not the first time you've seen this theme, have you? This is appearing in other places, right?
Well, absolutely, it is appearing in the other places. And if we go back to the RT article that we were just talking about, do go and watch that interview that Sophie Shevardnadze did on that. But it's very much the CIA speaking about Trump, and they are taking an opposing position to him.
Overwhelmingly, I think CIA probably preferred Hillary Clinton to win the 2016 elections, not Donald Trump. The ex-directors and so forth, like Brennan, have made no bones about that. They're never Trumpers, adamant campaigners. So there is a schism, Mike. There is a schism. And the CIA basically wagered the credibility on the high degree of confidence that Russia hacked or Russia meddled or colluded or whatever in the 2016 elections to get Trump elected. So this is a very real divide. Mm. This isn't anything that's not happening. So again, with the Donald.
What has he done?
He's lashing back, and I'm going to say, get ready to rumble. This came out yesterday, and you won't. So funny to see little Adam.
Shit. Is that a typo?
Schitt, or I don't know how. That's a typo. Okay. It's Adam Schiff. There's the correct spelling right there. Let me say, I think Donald Trump is aware of the correct spelling. So talking about the fact that Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, this is Stealth Jeff Sessions' replacement, they call him Stealth Jeff because no one saw him for 2 years, was not approved by the Senate, but not mentioning the fact that Bob Mueller, who is highly conflicted, was not approved by the Senate either. Well, there's another argument there. But Mike, this is serious, and it's blown up in the U.S. media. So Trump's even surpassed his own poor standards of, and so the Democrats are they're going crazy right now, raising Cain, saying he's lowered the honorability, the respectability of the office. He's undignified the office of the President of the United States. That may be true with that tweet, but the rest of the political establishment in America has already done that by floating out a conspiracy theory that the Russians colluded with Trump to win the election in 2016, 24/7, every single day for the last 2 years. So they've already downgraded the president, the White House, the Senate, the Congress, the whole U.S. government have made it a global laughingstock by inventing this conspiracy theory. So say what you want about Trump's foul language and misspellings, but I think the opposition has a lot to answer for really bringing the reputation of the United States down into the gutter. Mm. And the media too.
Now, in terms of Middle East geopolitics here, full steam ahead, it says RT, Russia and Turkey officially complete construction of the joint gas pipeline. Where does this leave Turkey's relationship with the United States?
Well, this is big. So Putin and Erdogan have finished the deal here, having a little ceremony this week to sort of christen this new project. Why is this important? Well, this is hugely important. We're talking about the Turk Stream pipeline here. Look at this. Now, currently, Russia's been supplying gas to Turkey via the Blue Stream pipeline. The new Turk Stream project is great for Turkey financially, but if you look at where it's connecting here, By the Bosphorus Straits, Mike. This is the entry point into the EU, to the southern market. So I believe that Gazprom has cleared the obstacles that existed before with supplying into the EU via Bulgaria. I think this is pretty much, it seems to be a done deal unless people can come in and scarper this. Viktor Orban in Hungary also wants to tap in on the evil Kremlin gas supply as well. So you can see this is going to become a big issue for Washington that's trying to do anything, sending bottles of LNG to Germany, cut price levels, anything to just keep Europe from becoming dependent on Russian gas, because the U.S. is telling Europe that it's a security issue. You can't be dependent on the evil Russians, because that's going to mean that, it means that you're not independent and you're controlled by the Kremlin. That's that's the general logic in Washington. At the end of the day, Mike, Russia's just done an amazing job to roll this out in record time, the Turk Stream pipeline. This has effectively shored up part of its relationship with Turkey. Great partner from bringing it back from the brink 3 years ago when relations were at all-time low. And now tapping into the Balkan states and supplying them with low-cost gas, soon into mainland Europe if that happens. So there's no other major energy supplier, Mike, to supply Europe that really needs a stable, constant supply of natural gas. Russia is the only country that can do this. So I'm afraid it's just a question of time before the economic reality hits.
And that's going to cause tensions between the United States and Europe as well?
It will. It's you can already see the rhetoric between Merkel and Trump over the gas issue. Now Russia's got them on the southern front as well. So the Nord Stream pipeline, that's still going ahead. So pretty soon, maybe Britain will have no choice, Mike, to accept the evil Kremlin gas. At a half the price of the Qatari LNG. Who knows?
Okay, well, look, we were talking about Benjamin Netanyahu on the Sunday Wire last night. What's the latest then?
This is an amazing story. We broke this down in detail with Robert Inlakesh on the radio last night. If you get a chance to go listen to that interview. But Netanyahu has basically increased his portfolio. Isn't it amazing? Through this crisis in Gaza, through the call of the ceasefire, the resignation of the ultra-right wing Avigdor Lieberman.
So yesterday they were talking about holding early elections. Are the early elections, is this idea scrapped, that he's grabbed more power to himself now?
He has grabbed more power in terms of his cabinet portfolio, Mike, but there's a few things that have gone on within the Israeli political situation that's going to make this potentially difficult for Netanyahu. They have 120 seats in the parliament. His coalition only has a one seat majority now, because Lieberman's party, Israeli Bietenu, they've left, basically. So this has now brought the coalition seats down from 61, I believe. The home party, if they pull out, Naftali Bennett, who wanted the defense position and said that if he didn't get it, he's going to bring the government down. If the home party leaves Netanyahu's coalition, that's going to bring the seats from 61 down to 53, okay? So already one representative could potentially hold the entire political system hostage until the next elections, which are November 2019. And what's amazing is Israel has never had a government sit through its full term. There's always been early elections since 1988. They've never had a full-term government. And that's because two reasons, either the prime minister was in trouble and needed to call in early elections to save himself or to reconsolidate power, or there's been some coalition crisis, basically. So we have here the Gaza ceasefire this past week, hugely unpopular for the hardliners, and a coalition crisis once again. But the polls show that Netanyahu could win election if there was an early election. Yes, but the problem is this might not actually be good timing. He doesn't know if he has the support to sort of put that coalition together. So it's funny times right now. And Netanyahu would be the longest serving leader in Israeli history if he was reelected. So president for life, 20 years now, going on for another 25 if he gets another term. And they talk about Assad, you know, being in power forever. Netanyahu's been in power longer, basically. But nobody's calling, no Western governments are calling for his ouster.
Okay, well, look, just briefly, of course, last week Jeremy Hunt was in Saudi Arabia, allegedly to deal with the Yemeni issue. That went well because he came back with a peace deal. In fact, he's probably gone and sold a whole lot more arms. But today he's in Iran and he's visiting Iran for the first time, holding talks with the Iranian government on the future of the Iranian nuclear deal, Iran's roles in Syria and Yemen. This is the most important point, the ongoing cases of detained British Iranian dual nationals. Of course, there are a couple of people in Iranian prisons on the basis of alleged spying on behalf of the British, including Ms. Zaghari Ratcliffe. We'll see how that pans out and whether he makes any progress. In the meantime, then, Patrick, we have North Korea. And, what's been going on? Well, of course, they're not doing this anymore that you can see on screen, which is launching their missiles. They've stopped doing that. But the allegations continue that they are involved in developing their nuclear capability, even though they've said that they're scrapping that nuclear capability. And so this is a joint statement, apparently, from the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the U.S. State Department. And they're meeting people from the insurance industry, the maritime insurance industry. So the Foreign Office has said that they have today met leading figures from the maritime insurance industry to discuss additional proactive and practical steps that the industry can take to further restrict the Democratic People's Republic of Korea illicit shipping practices. They say the DPRK uses these practices to evade sanctions in order to develop their UN-prohibited nuclear and missile programs. And what are the sanctions about? Refined petroleum. Patrick, so we're heading into the winter. There are sanctions in place to stop them importing fuels into the country, but apparently they're using those for their nuclear and missile programs and not for heating.
Allegedly.
That's the allegation.
How could you make a determination like that? It's absolutely impossible. So what is this, Mike? It's setting a precedent, basically. So it's bringing sanctions into a new realm, which is out of the sort of the state government realm, and into the sort of privatized realm. So if this is allowed to stand, Mike, this is hugely dangerous if you consider all the maritime activity globally in terms of trade and the independence of companies. Who knows, Mike? I wonder how this would be dealt with in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Corporate Court of Appeals.
Well, exactly.
It would be interesting to know.
Yeah. Okay, quick advertisement for Alternative View 9.1, Democracy in Chains, taking place in the Crown Plaza in London. On the 2nd of December, tickets available at alternativeview.co.uk. Do get along to that if you possibly can. Dr. Graham Downing speaking, Patrick Henningsen, Brian Gerrish, Alex Thompson and Ian R. Crane. Do you know what you're speaking about?
Yes, we'll be speaking about the fusion of government and corporate interests and how this is expressing itself in the form of mass censorship and many other related issues.
Okay, now we're just going to end with this one. This sort of brings us back to Theresa May, actually. So this is Poverty as a Political Choice. We'll come on to who it's according to in a second, but ministers in a state of denial about poverty. This is Philip Alston. Here he is. And he's saying levels of child poverty are not just a disgrace, but a social calamity and an economic disaster. And he's talking about research that's been done in the UK into levels of poverty. Staggering is the word that's been used. 1.5 million were destitute at some point in 2017, he said. So where's he getting this data from? It's this organisation, SMC, and they've produced a new measure of poverty in the UK. You can see a number of different foundations and think tanks involved in this research. And this is pretty much what they've come up with. 14.2 million people in the UK are in poverty. They're saying 8.4 million people in poverty are working age adults. They're saying 4.5 million children in poverty, 1.4 million pension age adults. And so what else are they saying? 12.1% of the total UK population, 7.7 million people, live in persistent poverty. And they're saying that there are 2.5 million people in the UK that are less than 10% above the poverty line. So they're blaming this, of course, on the Conservative Party's austerity program over the last number of years. But it goes even beyond that, perhaps, because, if we look at how it's not just about austerity, it's about other government policies as well. And we look at how government policy with regard to the economy has changed. And, Patrick, it was the same under Obama in the United States. It's the same here. We talk about jobs all the time and the number of jobs being created. And we never discuss the types of jobs that are being created and whether these are high value jobs or whether they're low value jobs. And of course, many of these people that are in poverty are working families that are receiving so-called top-up benefits, and the poverty situation is getting worse as universal credit is rolled out, because that seems to be an absolute disaster for people. And the government is not doing anything about it because of their general policy about the types of jobs that they want to promote. And we're not, as Theresa May was saying in her speech to the CBI this morning, it's services that are important. Manufacturing is not important. High-skilled or at least middle-skilled jobs are not important. There's an increasing breach between the people on highest salaries and the rest, and also the people with highest skills and the rest. So there's an elite of high-skilled workers involved in high technology businesses, and the rest are serving coffee and stacking shelves. And really, that is a major problem.
And wages haven't kept pace, Mike, at all with the cost of living. This is a perennial problem going back decades now. So, you know, some job wages haven't really changed in 20 years, Mike, 25 years. And the cost of living has doubled in some cases. And the gouging that's going on with regards to privatization of utilities and also transport, train fares and bus fares, et cetera, all these things add up. So people are just out of pocket much more than before. And they're not being, the gap's not being closed by higher income. So it's a simple math equation.
Yes.
You have less money in your pocket, if you have any, most people are on credit, quite frankly. So what is that? That's technically poverty, yes. The other thing, Mike, I'm going to say the last thing is, it is a visible increase in homeless people I've seen on the streets in the last year, just in the last year alone. And probably there's people out there listening and watching who've noticed the same thing. And it's becoming more pronounced, and I would say this winter will probably be some of the worst that we've seen. But and I'm not exaggerating. Stepping over people in Plymouth,
yes,
that was never the case 2-3 years ago. Mm. So something's going on, and I don't think any of the reassuring statements by the government are really going to.
They're not going to cut it.
It's not going to cut it in this case. Yeah.
Okay. Look, we're going to leave it there. We are going to do a UK column news extra in a few minutes. We've got a special guest in the studio who's going to join us for that. So if you're a UK column member or a 21st Century Wire member, you'll be able to watch that on the relevant websites later on today. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for joining us today, Patrick. We will be back at the same time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.